Thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or support the podcast on Patreon or Teespring if you feel inclined. We have two guests today, one being a repeat customer. Jason Schooley was interviewed all the way back in episode 27. He was born and raised in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and received his bachelor's in zoology from Oklahoma State University in 2002. After graduating, he worked in the Arizona State University Native Fishes Lab with Dr. Paul Marsh and Dr. Tom Dowling, monitoring and restoring numerous native and imperiled desert fishes. In 2008, he began his master's degree at Arizona State, focusing on evaluating restoration stocking success for the endangered razorback sucker. In 2009, he joined the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation, working part-time at the Paddlefish Research Center. He was then hired as a paddlefish biologist in 2010 and promoted to senior biologist in 2018. And he roped in a new guest to the show, Dr. Dennis Skarnecchia. Dennis is professor of fisheries at the University of Idaho, Moscow. He teaches courses in fisheries management and large river fisheries. He has conducted considerable research on trout and Pacific salmon in the western U.S., on Atlantic salmon in Iceland, and on large river and reservoir fisheries. He has studied paddlefish for 30 years in Montana, North Dakota, and other states, assisting these agencies with their management of the species. Dennis has been working with Jason in the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation for 12 years, since the inception of their Paddlefish Research Center in Miami, Oklahoma, on paddlefish stock assessment. He has also authored a well-known paper on gar and bowfin management relevant to today's topic. Welcome to the podcast, Jason and Dennis.
Hello, Nick. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thanks very much, Nick. Good to be here.
So at the very tail end of the bio, I mentioned that Dr. Skarnecchia authored a relevant paper on gar and bowfin. It is relevant because both of you wanted to do an episode on a new paper you have out in the Transactions of the Kansas Academy of Science titled Bowfishing in the United States, History, Status, Ecological Impact, and a Need for Management. The paper is broken down into several sections, and one of those being a case study of the 2018 U.S. Bowfishing Open. Was this the original inspiration for the paper?
Yeah, it kind of was. Really, there was no inspiration. It was more serendipitous. One of our game wardens got a phone call from Bass Pro in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, which is a suburb of Tulsa. And they said, hey, we're about to have this big bowfishing tournament. And we were wondering if somebody from Oklahoma Department of Wildlife might want to set up an information booth and pass out regs, answer questions about bowfishing. And I kind of jumped at that opportunity and asked them in turn, hey, how do you feel about us participating in the tournament, surveying the bow fishers and collecting some data from the weigh-in? And they were jazzed about it. They're like, great, we'd love to cooperate with Department of Natural Resource. And so it kind of went from there. We learned a lot at that tournament. And then honestly, that once we had some data, we started thinking about, you know, what do we do with this data? And we're looking more into, you know, the literature on bow fishing. And that's when we kind of identified a need for something bigger. And maybe Dennis can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, Jason and Nick, I think, you know, the original intent was to write a short paper summarizing the tournament and the findings and leave it at that. And of course, Jason was leading that, and then he visited with some people, and I was one of them, about how we might want to deal with that. But when we looked online into what was being written and shown in videos on bow fishing and written and shown in videos, both, it was really clear to us that bow fishing had been greatly increasing in popularity and participation in the past decade. You can see that from all the stuff out there. A lot of websites, a lot of YouTube videos, advertising guide services, bow fishing opportunities for many different species of fish, in fact, freshwater and marine, even for marine fish like rays. But we also found that although there was a whole lot being written on bow fishing, there was almost nothing on bow fishing management out there. We only found about four or five short papers looking all the way back that we could find, as far as we looked, which was a century or so, only about four or five papers, mostly on local tournaments and results from specific states, mainly Arkansas, South Dakota, Texas, Illinois. those primarily, but very little on the history and development, the technological improvements as they affected management, or virtually nothing in an organized format on state management regulations for bow fishing. So we, Jason and I, decided to prepare a short survey for state agencies to describe bow fishing and its management in their states. And Jason sent it out to all 50 states, and 48 of them responded directly to the survey. And the other thing is that we also found out while we were doing all this is that whereas some managers knew quite a lot about bow fishing, other fisheries managers knew very little or nothing about this kind of specialized sport. So we decided there was a genuine need for a comprehensive paper on bow fishing, specifically designed for managers on all aspects of it. We wouldn't be repeating anybody by preparing a paper like that. And so it was, the paper we developed was intended to be a really a thorough review of the history, development, status, and management needs of bow fishing, kind of a one-stop, up-to-date, up-to-speed review of the topic, again, mainly for state managers, but also for federal managers in places like wildlife refuges. So we started out with a paper that was going to have about one section in it. We wound up with a paper that had about seven of it, and seven sections. And I think the main sections that are relevant to modern fisheries today are the last three, where what we learned from the U.S. Open Tournament in Broken Arrow, what we learned from the management survey of all 50 states, and what a lot of neat scientific studies around the country have been telling us over the last 15 to 20 years about some of the species that are bowfish and how they need to be managed. So that's kind of what the focus of the paper is.
And you mentioned that there's several areas or several pieces of information that you thought were lacking from the literature, and you include those as separate sections in this paper. And the first of those sections breaks down the history of bow fishing, or bow hunting and bow fishing. Was there a fact that you two uncovered during your research that might have surprised you?
I had done a lot of research into sort of ethnology and Native American uses of harvest technology, fisheries, that sort of thing. And we visited on this a little bit, and we got started on it. We weren't sure how far to go into it, but one of the things we found out was that there was a lot of scattered information out there about the development of a bow and arrow, the increases in technology, development of bow fishing by a lot of indigenous tribes around the world, a lot in the United States, a lot other places as well. And it had really never been put together. Nobody had ever really put that together. So we decided to do that, focusing mainly on the United States. One of the key things we found, I think, was is that bow fishing is practiced by a lot of the native tribes, had a lot of the same characteristics as people practicing it today. They used bow fishing as a training tool. They used it for recreation, relaxation. They used it for honing their hunting skills. You know, it was used in a lot of the same ways that a lot of the modern sportsmen and sportswomen use bow fishing today. And the other thing we found that was kind of interesting was that bow fishing itself is not uniformly distributed in terms of the native tribes around the country. There was a lot in the Southeast, not a lot in the Great Plains, not a lot in the Pacific Northwest. It looks like those tribes had probably more efficient ways to catch fish with weirs and traps and things like that. And bow fishing was ideally suited to a lot of places in the Southeast. Probably the third thing we found on it was interesting to look back on some of the references, is that some of the native tribes, particularly the Southeastern tribes, the Chickasaws, Choctaws, and tribes such as that, they were using bow fishing in conjunction with local sources of rotenone that they had. So they were using rotenone in the water as a fish toxicant, and then they would bow fish on top of the fish after they had applied rotenone. So we put that in the paper because we thought it was kind of an interesting twist that's very relevant to modern fisheries management, I think.
And the next section talks about the modernization or evolution of bow fishing. There are four quotes at the beginning of your paper that I think kind of go into the modernization of bow fishing, and they are USA Archery says, whether you are a beginning, intermediate, or advanced archer, archery will give you something that's almost impossible to find elsewhere. And then Maurice Thompson in The Witchery of Archery says, archery is a sport as harmless and fascinating as it is old and honorable. And then the quotes move to maybe the more modern form, or at least the way some biologists view the modern form. Margaret Atwood saying every aspect of human technology has a dark side, including the bow and arrow. And then Relentless Anglin says, what are we looking for? Basically any trash fish that will swim, but the main target today is going to be some gars. Was that kind of intentional, or do you think that bow fishing in its current form has fallen victim to kind of a one-up trophy fishing culture?
I think we sort of had those sort of concepts in mind as we addressed the subject. We wanted to touch on some of the more controversial concepts, but at the same time, we intentionally avoided taking an anti-bow fishing stance because that's not helpful. Our goal with this was to provide information, a source of the most updated information on bow fishing. Like Dennis said, try to write a paper that was a one-stop shop where a manager could pick this up if they knew nothing about bow fishing and get a pretty good foundation of what the sport is all about and where it comes from and what some concerns about where it may be headed could be. So yeah, we selectively chose some quotes that sort of put you in the mind of people in and around archery, not only as practitioners of archery, but potentially how archers may be seen by other people. And yeah, we touched on some of the psychological and sociological aspects of the sport as well, particularly some of the ways in which archery has been proven beneficial for therapeutic reasons. We noted how some researchers have demonstrated that it's effective in helping treat people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, also breath control, etc. So we definitely wanted to paint bow fishing within the greater sport of archery as, you know, a nuanced topic that definitely has pros, but it also has some cons. And we wanted to present that, you know, in the best, most unbiased way we could, however, highlighting the ways in which bow fishing interacts with some of these native non-game species, which unfortunately are not afforded really any sort of sustainable management throughout the United States. So our overarching goal was to address bow fishing and its impacts on native fishes, but we made sure that we tried to present it in a way to where we weren't taking an anti-bow fishing stance. I think that was pretty important to us throughout the process.
Yeah, and I think Jason covered it really well. I think that there's one statement at the end of our abstract which kind of sums it up. It says, we seek to provide agencies information for developing historical, ecological, and socioeconomic perspectives for managing bow fisheries as other fisheries, as instruments of species conservation, public benefit, and sound long-term public policy. Our approach was to look at the scientific information and see what it said, and then see if and how bow fisheries can be used as instruments of species conservation, public benefit, and sound long-term public policy. And so if they can, then that's we wanted that depicted too. So we didn't really want to take an advocacy stance in this. We didn't think we had to. We wanted to provide objective information for the managers on all sides of it. And those quotes were kind of a collage of all the different things people are saying about bow fishing, from all the different perspectives. And so some of the reviewers want us to take them out. We said, no, we'd like to leave them in because we wanted the readers to see all the different ways people look at bow fishing because it is a complex topic.
Definitely it is. I agree.
The third topic kind of covers the sport governance and the emergence of tournaments, and we'll come back around to that a few questions. But we mentioned the case study earlier. The paper describes the U.S. Bow Fishing Open as the Super Bowl of bow fishing. And just 2 years earlier, Oklahoma hosted the Super Bowl of bass fishing, the Bassmaster Classic. Working in Oklahoma, Jason, I'm sure you had to man a booth or were at least familiar enough with the Bassmaster Classic. Do you have any inference on how the two tournaments compared?
the Bassmaster Classic is obviously much more pomp and circumstance, a whole lot more commercial activity going on TV and lots of million-dollar teams here and there. Whereas the U.S. Open is much more approachable sort of tournament for bow fishers. I mean, yeah, there's an entry fee and a lot of these teams traveled a long ways to get here, but there were quite a few, you know, local Oklahoma bow fishing teams that whether or not they were competing prior to the U.S. Open, they were up there with the big boys and, you know, competing for the same big check for $25,000. So it was quite enlightening, but they're definitely on a different level. And whether or not bow fishing is evolving towards that much pomp and circumstance is another question. But, you know, a key factor in that is the impacts on the resource. And that's sort of what we wanted to get at with this. What, you know, what species were being taken by bow fishing at what numbers. And we wanted to sort of make an initial inquiry into who are bow fishers. How are they doing this? What are some things that a manager needs to think about in, you know, providing opportunities for the sport, but also competitive opportunities within tournaments? So it's pretty interesting. And there are bow fishing tournaments that have been occurring for decades now. And we highlighted one of those in the paper, the Grand Lake Bow Fishing Championship, I believe it's called. And that's an interesting case study in itself. We didn't talk about a lot of detail about it, but just seeing the growth in the tournament data from that alone sort of tells you how a sport like this can increase in popularity and how important it is regarding resource management.
Yeah, that Great Lakes Bow Fishing Championship that you mentioned has been hosting tournaments for nearly 40 years, and you include a nice table of the number of teams and the amount of fish they harvest, and they average 220 teams registering over the 36-year span, and nearly 40 tons of fish harvested every year, which that's a pretty extreme example. I'd imagine that's one of the biggest and longest living tournaments, but it's still kind of a jarring number how big some of these tournaments can get and how many fish they can remove.
Obviously, smaller localized tournaments are not attracting that many teams. However, they're potentially happening a lot more often. I mean, those big tournaments, most of which the large, big money, high dollar sponsorship tournaments are kind of a new phenomenon over the last decade. We kind of addressed that topic in the paper as well. But it's not necessarily to paint that in a bad light, the impacts of the harvest from these big tournaments. Some of those tournaments have actually focused on targeting invasive carps instead of native species. So that sort of demonstrates what sort of large-scale impact a tournament can have on some of these invasive species, to which we're kind of trying to advocate for diverting the efforts of bow fishers away from native non-game species onto these invasive Asian carps, for example.
So you mentioned I believe it was the U.S. Open held down in Memphis that targeted only invasive carp. Do you foresee a day where state agencies might be trying to solicit these larger bow fishing tournaments to come to their reservoirs to thin out some species? I know here in Kansas, we contract commercial fishermen to thin out buffalo and common carp out of Milford Reservoir to try to curb blue-green algae blooms. Do you see a day where state agencies might say, hey, bring your bow fishermen over here as a cheaper alternative than contract commercial fishing?
That's an interesting idea, and I think that needs to be something understood and considered by state agencies. We, of course, in the paper advocate for these agencies to really examine all of these topics around the sport, one of which, of course, the big one is, you know, invasive species, because that's a positive way to direct the energy and the efforts of bow fishers. And so we would certainly and I think Dennis would agree with me, advocate for states seeking creative outlets for bow fishers. They're very passionate about their sport. They're very competitive, and putting that to good use, I think, would be pretty wise.
Part of the paper is also about the national status of and state regulation. And to do this, you sent a survey to all state agencies to learn their views of bow fishing. I guess, overall, were the responses on par with what you were thinking, or were they a little less or better than what you were thinking?
I can speak to that. I don't know that we really had any preconceived notions about what the responses would be, but they were certainly educational. You know, I am a state manager of native species. I work with paddlefish primarily. But so I am part of the target audience of this paper. So I wasn't really sure what other states were experiencing and what they thought about the sport. I did have my own preconceived notions, but I did not personally respond to the survey. One of my coworkers did. But it was interesting. We were under the impression that bow fishing was in an expansion phase, and that was kind of reinforced by the survey responses. 52% of states that responded said that bow fishing was increasing in popularity in their state. We weren't really surprised at this, but bow fishing is legal in all 50 states. But I guess the most shocking statistic that we got, which wasn't necessarily unexpected, was that zero states reported having any sort of management plans or objectives or goals related to bow fishing. And very little information is being collected on bow fishers by the states, either through just generic angling surveys or even targeted surveys. There were a couple exceptions to that. But for the most part, a lot of the concerns voiced by state managers were related to inadequacies in data. Not only inadequacies in data on bow fishers, but data on how many fish bow fishers are taking out, inadequate data on what species are being targeted, et cetera. So those are kind of things that can be addressed with some focused management. Yeah, the results we got from the states were pretty enlightening, and we go into those in pretty good depth in the paper, but they're all, you know, issues that can be discussed and considered and potentially addressed through the basic tools and methods that we have for managing fisheries of all types across the United States.
And in the final section of the paper, the need for bow fishing management, you kind of summarize everything and conclude the paper with 10 main points that you leave the reader with, or 10 main issues. And I will kind of bounce around them. I won't go through them in order. We kind of bounce around them. The third one is how to evaluate and manage these fisheries in regard to age, size, and sex-specific data. And I think Alec Lackman's paper on bigmouth buffalo that was released earlier this year, last year, time has escaped me in 2020, but it really raised some eyebrows about how old some of these fish can get. Are you aware of any other studies since then or in the works that have looked at some of these popular bow fishing targets?
Jason, I can visit on that briefly. Yes, I think that's one of the key parts of this last section of the paper, is that in the last two decades, there's been an awful lot of information become available on a lot of these native species that a lot of the state agencies and federal agencies have taken a closer look at. And there were several key things that jumped out at us when we actually reviewed that literature. We tried not to just say, this person found this or that person found that. We tried to put it all together and see what it meant in terms of what does it mean for bow fishing. And a few points jumped out at us. The first point that jumped out at us was that a lot of these native species have recently, within the last 20 years, been found to live to a lot older age than we ever thought. Alec Lackman's paper stands out, of course, finding bigmouth buffalo in Minnesota that are over 100 years old, you know, the oldest freshwater fish that we're dealing with that we know of, that we've specifically documented, and he was able to validate these ages on these fish. But the alligator gar is has been found to live at least 85 to 90 years, live 85 to 90 years. The paddlefish that I've been working with up in Montana, North Dakota, have been found to live at least 50 to 60 years, probably older than that. Lachman found a lot of the other sucker species that he's worked with, buffalo fishes and other suckers, also live a lot longer than we thought they did, including the blue sucker, which is people in Kansas have actually looked at that and found that. So there are a lot of these species that are living to a lot older age than we thought. And so that's the first thing is a lot of these native fish are really fish that have to be managed more carefully than we thought they did because they live to an old age, and that's their natural life history. The second thing we found about a lot of those fish is that a lot of those fish reproduce and recruit to the population very sporadically, sometimes episodically, not very often at all in many cases. And so Lachman found very poor recruitment of his buffalo. We've found sporadic recruitment in paddlefish. People are finding the same thing in gars. And so there's sporadic recruitment, which indicates that you've got to manage around that sporadic recruitment and let these fish live to this long age, because this old age, because again, that's part of their life history. The third thing we found that a lot of people hadn't thought about, I think, was this idea of sexual size dimorphism. And what I mean by that is that if you think about what they harvest and by what's harvested by bow hunters, they're shooting deer or elk or something like that. All the males tend to be larger than the females because of their life history strategy, whereby the larger males compete effectively for access to the females. And so the males get larger than the females. With every species that we looked at that's bowfished, the opposite is the case. The largest fish are females. And they're the ones that are going to be selectively removed from the population. And so we need to manage these native fishes a lot more carefully because of these three factors than we had realized 15 to 20 years ago. And so those are three of the things that stood out to us right away as things that managers need to take a lot closer look at. And, you know, I've over the years, and one other thing we had in the paper was a lot of fisheries have historically been managed with things like minimum size limits and things like that. And that favors taking all the big fish out, which will preferentially take the females out. And so we have a figure in the paper where it shows that we really need to figure out some ways where we can keep these old fish, these old native fish in the population, especially these old female fish, and let the fish live out its natural life cycle, the stock of fish that we're harvesting, rather than just have the fish be truncated in terms of age and size, and we're cropping off all the big old fish, which again will be preferentially female. So those were some key things that came out of the studies that have been done by biologists all over the country in the last 20 years. And we reviewed all that and synthesized it and tried to make some sense of it. And it's very relevant to how we manage our bow fisheries for native fish.
So after gathering all that information and maybe still seeking out some unknown questions that might be out there, the next big issue would be the need to implement education programs to change a longstanding intergenerational biases against misunderstood native species. And I think this might be the largest hurdle to clear with the topic of bow fishing, because just so many people have the belief ingrained in their head for some reason that gar and carp and buffalo are all just trash fish. How long realistically do you think it would take to change the majority of people's minds about that?
Tough question. And I think it really starts with, like we keep saying, it starts with the state managers, because right now there's not a whole lot of people across the nation on the ground collecting data on these species. And those are the data that we need in order to make an adequate case to the general public that these fishes shouldn't just be shot indiscriminately. Or if they are shot with bow fishing, it needs to be in a controlled bow fishery, something that's managed sustainably. So the education really isn't the first step in that process, in my opinion. It's really getting managers to recognize the need for information. And I think that that was universally recognized among the survey results we got from the state agencies. They acknowledged that a lack of data is really what's the first stepping stone to managing these species. And so I think, you know, we're presenting that to them in this paper. We're suggesting, you know, ways to have the conversations, and not only for the purpose of management, but then to evolve that conversation into how do we educate the public, educate bow fishers as a constituency, and really kind of meet in the middle by providing some opportunities for them to do this in a sustainable and responsible fashion.
Yeah, I think we tried to separate in the paper the and this is what the evidence that we were able to find suggested to us, was that some of the, as Jason indicated earlier, a lot of the non-native invasive species, carp, Asian carps, grass carp, fish like that, even on the West Coast, you might even take a look at a native fish, American shad, because it's not native to the West Coast, but it is native to the East Coast. So you might take a look at some of those fishes that are non-native in their habitats and utilize bow fishing more effectively. But the data that we were able to find in the last 20 years suggested clearly that we need to take a much more serious approach to managing a lot of these native species. Years ago, I worked a lot with Atlantic salmon in Iceland, and nobody ever questioned that the Atlantic salmon was a great fish. But if I said that the alligator gar was a great fish, or I said that the bigmouth buffalo that lives 100 years was a great fish, a lot of people would question me. And frankly, I'm not sure why, having worked with all of these types of fish and around, it's just a, it's a subtle aspect of human perception. And a lot of our native fishes are a lot more valuable than we've given them credit for. And it, and if that's our, if that's going to be our approach, is to maintain our native fishes and native ecosystems to that, to the extent that we can, then bow fishing may be able to be used as part of that overall plan. We didn't try to make the 10 statements that the managers would look at prescriptive. We didn't try to tell them exactly what to do, because that's not, was not the role of this paper, and it was not our intention. Our intention was to be descriptive in the paper, describe what we did know, and make some suggestions about some things that the agencies would probably want to look at, maybe through their national organizations and groups like AFWA, the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, or CEFWA, the Southeastern Association, for example. You know, they can look at them, and they're very well qualified to prescribe things in different areas. But we did suggest 10 areas of that they would probably want to look into, just because of, just based on our review.
Another one of the those issues was the lack of productive use of the vast majority of fish, especially native fishes, killed by bow fishing, and when wanton waste constitutes a problem. And in the management concerns section, you also know that wanton waste is a common concern from state agencies, including my state of Kansas. And I was surprised to learn, according to our game wardens, that wanton waste applies only to sport fish in Kansas. Are you aware of any other states that have similar wanton waste rules? And I guess along those same lines, do you think another issue is first having to educate agency staff, specifically game wardens, of the importance of some of these quote-unquote trash fish that bow fishermen target?
Yeah, I think, you know, you're going to get different definitions of sort of these legal issues in different states. I know that Oklahoma is different than Kansas, and in many states, it may not even be spelled out, you know, what wanton waste is, what the proper way to dispose of fish remains or fish carcasses is. I know that in our Oklahoma statutes, it's kind of loosely referenced in three or four different places, and we're kind of in a process right now where we're trying to consolidate that stuff to where it's not only more clear and simplified, but it's also easier thing to enforce. And so you mentioned, you know, game wardens, law enforcement agents working for the state DNRs. Yeah, and they're part of our they're on our team here to sort of change the way that our constituents feel about these species. But at the same time, we've also got to advocate for the species and make sure that the game wardens understand what we're talking about here biologically and why they're important. So if we're looking to maybe change regulations or change laws that deal with the harvest limits for these species and whatnot, we got to make sure that we're showing a unified front here. So game wardens are part of that team, and we got to make sure we craft regulations in a smart and responsible way so that they do benefit the resource, and that we have our law enforcement agents able to help us with that process. So one, waste is one of the most visually obvious issues with bow fishing that causes management concern and public concern, because there maybe is no, on average, most fishes taken by bow fishing are not done for sustenance. They may be disposed of properly, they may be used as fertilizer or whatnot, but what we're trying to convey is that these non-game native species with complex and important life histories are important enough that they should be valued as more than fertilizer or more than just taking up space in a dumpster. Removing them is not helpful for the fish community at large. Having them in our waters across the nation is not harmful to game species, despite sort of the opinions held by some state managers of decades past. It's a multifaceted educational campaign, and of course it starts with educating ourselves, and then we got to pass that education on to our coworkers and our constituents, and in the end, hopefully we'll find a place where the true value of these native non-game fishes are known by everybody, and these bow fisheries are managed responsibly.
You mentioned there that the first step was to educate ourselves, and a few of the different issues or points that you pointed out all evolve around basically just getting more information about bow fishers in general, such as whether you need a permit or how to monitor the fisheries after and bow fishing and its potential effects on the species, and then commitment to researching non-harvest mortality. But a lot of these are great ideas, but the 10th and final issue you point out is how to fund these management efforts in the context of existing programs and new programs where necessary. How many states do you think will just say it's all a good idea, but then ultimately it'll fall aside because they just don't have the finances to spread personnel to other projects?
We didn't forget about funding. we put it at the end. It was in the last section. We talked about the role of archery in the Pittman-Robertson program, the Federal Aid to Wildlife Restoration program, and how archery became involved with that program through some efforts. So we went through the whole history of how that developed. But then we noted that with a very few exceptions, all of the archery money that goes into the federal aid program goes into the wildlife side, and it doesn't go into the fishery side, the Wallop Bro program or the Dingle Johnson Wallop Bro programs. It doesn't go into those, and it never has, except for a few specific items. And so one of the recommendations we made is that the states take a hard look at how many people are... how many archers are hunting, bow hunting for terrestrial species, how many archers are bow fishing, and then the value of those relative fisheries, and then allocate the money accordingly. It may need a reallocation, it may not, but we thought that was one of the first places that you would look. And the other, and that's the first thing. And then the other thing also is that a lot of these rough species, historically so-called rough species, and we're trying to get away from that connotation, but a lot of these species that were historically viewed that way were not considered good subjects for a lot of these federal aid research programs. And their value as bow fishing species and their increasing value for recreation suggests that a lot of them are. And so, there are several ways that that can, that we can probably make sure that these native species are getting the funding, the proportion of the funding that they're entitled to, given their importance and their overall usage. And so we did say something about that. But Jason, maybe you'd like to say more about that.
Yeah, a little bit. I think just to kind of circle back, you know, what we learned by surveying the U.S. Open tournament was that it would take a heck of a lot of manpower and time and potentially not achieve the goals we wanted to achieve by trying to survey bow fishers with the traditional creel or male survey methods that we employ right now for hook and line anglers. Whereas doing targeted surveys at tournaments, I think you get a heck of a lot of bang for your buck. I mean, we were there for a total of maybe 6 hours over a weekend surveying these bow fishers. And so if you think about, we got data off 516 bow fishermen and thousands of fish. Whereas in our mailing angler surveys, I don't think we're adequately representing bow fishers through those. Those data are skewed heavily to hook and line fishermen. So one way to deal with some of the budgeting issues and to also be able to collect some of that data, I think initially, is to focus our efforts on targeted surveys at tournament events. And in order to do that adequately, I mean, you may have to have cooperation from tournament promoters, bow fishing clubs, potentially other oversight organizations like the Bow Fishing Association of America, for example. But I think that's one of the low-hanging fruits that we can do now, or at least when tournaments kick up next year when the water starts to get warmer. So that's something you can do now, and it doesn't require a whole lot of time effort. It doesn't require a whole lot of financial expenditures. So I think that's an easy suggestion. You know, you can get a lot more intense on stuff like that and talk about, you know, tournaments and other ways to survey these anglers. But there are some simple steps that are not necessarily budget limiting that we can look at.
You know, if I can follow up on Jason's comments there, for the last 12 years, Jason and I have been working with the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation's Paddlefish Research Center. And that's a really good example of how a system can be set up to collect data that's inexpensively for management that can feed back into the management process. We do the same thing up in Montana, North Dakota with the paddlefish. Jason talked about the value of looking at these tournaments. And managers nationally haven't really given very much thought to how to design fisheries so that they yield the kinds of data that managers need to provide better fisheries, kind of in a positive feedback loop. That's what we've tried to do for the paddlefish, and that's ultimately where this may need to go for these bow fisheries and a lot of other fisheries for native species. Is managers need to take a little harder look, perhaps, at how to design fisheries so that they provide the information that the managers need to do a good job to provide fishing for the public and to support the public trust doctrines. Far as management's concerned. So there's a lot that can be done in these areas. Ultimately, the fishers can provide a lot of this information if the fisheries are designed in certain ways. And so perhaps more thought should go into that. And Jason's discussion and a discussion in the paper about the working with the tournaments. It's just an aspect of that.
Yeah, I think Dennis just kind of reminded me of sort of an interesting concept that we went through while preparing these data in this paper. We initially kind of wanted to title it, you know, with the term proactive management, but we quickly realized that no, we're beyond the proactive stage. We're in the reactive stage. And I don't think that that's necessarily a permanent phase. I think we need to transition more into proactive management by doing exactly what Dennis was advocating, was creating controlled opportunities for bow fishing. So we have a framework in which bow fishing is potentially sustainable within our state and within our habitats and for species that we're able to monitor. And by doing that, we're proactively providing an opportunity to utilize this sport in a healthy way. And at the same time, we're doing it in such a way to where that fishery provides us the data we need to ensure that it's sustainable for the long term. So that would be sort of an ultimate goal to reach. And whether or not that means sort of starting fresh or creating new opportunities, such as for some of these Asian carps that are invading our nation. But there are, you know, we got responses from several state managers who were creating or considering creating new bow fishing opportunities for their constituents based on the sort of certain ecology or fish availability they had in certain habitats where that they thought it would be a healthy opportunity to utilize that method of take. So we definitely encourage that sort of thought process, and rather than trying to restrict stuff that's already there, potentially think about how can we use this sport in a responsible way by creating opportunities.
I think it's brilliantly summed up in the final paragraph of the paper, where you quoted Henry Longfellow's poem, The Arrow and the Song. I shot an arrow into the air, it fell to earth, I know not where. Then you end with the final sentence that to prevent this from becoming a reality in the realm of management of bow fisheries, managers need to know the bow fishers, work with them, but proactively and judiciously manage their arrows as they fall so they know how many, where, when, and on which species. Yeah, I think that's a great way to sum up the paper. The paper's already generating a lot of discussion. I know the fish chief of my agency has sent it out and said that there should be a discussion on this following. So to begin that discussion, is there a state agency out there that some other states might be able to look at to serve as an example to when they begin to develop a plan, or will it be kind of a piecemeal taking what one state does and another?
Well, boy, I don't know. We're kind of in that phase now where we've produced this paper and we are soliciting feedback from state agencies. So I don't necessarily think that we're in a position now to say, look at state X and emulate what they're doing. Because like I said, most of the states that we've gotten feedback from are really in the infancy stage of thinking about managing for this sport. But I think that, you know, with the writing of the paper sort of in the rearview mirror now, I think Dennis and I have kind of sort of solidified or crystallized the ideas in our head now, and I just wanted to sort of sum it up with four quick little points. So we talked about doing surveys and collecting data and what do we do with that, and educating our anglers and constituents and et cetera. And I think, you know, really it kind of comes down to managers through surveys need to know who's bow fishing, where they're doing it, and for what species. And then paired with that, we need to do surveys that complement the life history studies on bowfish species. So we need to be looking at the anglers, what they're doing, where they're doing it, what species they're harvesting, and we need to understand the life history of those species. And then with that information, we can do two things. We can create and promote responsibly managed bowfishing opportunities, while also providing adequate educational resources to all bow fishers. So we have the opportunity here to really kind of change the way this is happening. It's the Wild West, it's currently unregulated, but it doesn't have to stay that way. And there's no reason for all these native fishes to reach a point of unregulated harvest where they're unrecoverable. that may have happened already in certain locations, but I think that we're catching bow fishing in the expansion phase, and bow fishing management is lagging far behind, but we can catch up. And I just think that we need to sort of move the conversation away from the shock and awe phase and into the management phase, and let's start developing plans and frameworks to do it responsibly.
Yeah, and if I can follow up on Jason's stuff, and I agree with everything he said about that, you know, we need this data, we need all these things. A lot of these things that are things that states such as Kansas and other states can do and probably will be doing and should be doing, you know, I think. One of the things that we did mention in the paper is that a good starting point for looking at this thing more nationally would be to work through some of these interstate groups, AFWA, MICRA, perhaps the Mississippi Interstate Cooperative Resource Association. These are consortia of states that can work together, and they can perhaps develop their framework thinking on bow fishing and some of their target goals and objectives, things that they want to do. And then and all the states are involved with, say, AFWA and CIFWA and MICRA and these whichever group or groups want to take a lead on this thing, if any of them do. And then within that, each state can then have their own programs that can tailor to their own particular needs and opportunities in their state. So they'll have that kind of autonomy, and yet they can be interacting and cooperating with these other states where it's relevant through these multi-state or interstate groups. And so that was our suggestion. And a lot of the things that Jason just mentioned are things that we can do, are things that can be done on a state level. They can also be, to whatever extent the states want, coordinated at a multi-state level. So that's really what we tried to do, is to get people thinking about this program. We didn't really want to think we were qualified or in a position to dictate what people should do with bow fishing. We're just trying to provide information so the states can do just, and the agencies can do just what Jason and I described, and move ahead and get management caught up with the fisheries themselves. Because right now, as Jason said, we're way behind.
Well, it's definitely a great paper that I'm sure will spur a whole bunch of conversations between agencies and management biologists alike. And I'm definitely looking forward to taking a deeper dive into the paper, reading again when I have more time, and looking forward to some of that discussion that comes from it. But now the tough part of the interview is over, as we are down to the final five questions. And Jason, you've had your turn at these, so I figured that I would just ask Dennis these questions. And this is a group of five questions.
I agree.
This is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
What is my favorite fish? I will say this, and it's not a political statement. I like all fish. Fish are nature's gift to the humans, and I just like all fish. I really do. If I had to choose one, I'd say probably the paddlefish. I've worked with them most of my career. It's it has many unique aspects to it, and that would be the one that I would pick. I work with Atlantic salmon. I work with Pacific salmon. A lot of people think those are great fish, but I'll take the paddlefish over them. And I think some of the listeners should realize that in my lifetime, paddlefish has been, and in some quarters is still, considered a rough fish, but it's anything but. So paddlefish would be the one.
We highlighted a pretty outstanding sounding career in your bio, but what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
My favorite memory has been working with three states, Montana Fish, Wildlife and Parks, North Dakota Game and Fish Department, and the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation. That's been the most enjoyable thing. And I enjoy teaching. I enjoy all the things I do at the university. But working with the agencies, working with managers like Jason, like the managers I work with in the other states, I feel like managers, and I've said this before, managers have a tougher job than professors do. They have the tough job. They're trying to manage the fish in a very complex socioeconomic environment. So working with the managers, being able to assist them, working with them as equals, where they can tell me if they think I'm wrong, and I can tell them if I think they're wrong. That's what the kind of relationship Jason and I have. That's the kind of relations I have with the other states. That's been the most enjoyable thing. And that's been happening year in and year out. And that's what I look back on as number one.
All right. And what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
You know, a lot of people wondered why I went to Oklahoma and on the Great Plains and other places when I was out here in the Great Northwest. And about all I can say is that the nice thing about fisheries is that everywhere you go, there's neat fish and interesting problems everywhere, every state. And I have no particular place where I'd necessarily like to be or settle. I enjoy working in Oklahoma every bit as much as I enjoy working in Idaho or Montana or Iceland or Colorado or wherever else I've worked. And I don't know if I have a dream place, and I don't know if I have a dream job, but I do know that as a fishery biologist, we have two clients. We have the people and then we have the fish. And I like doing things for the fish. They need representation. And I like working with people like Jason and other people that also care about the fish. So it doesn't matter where I'm doing it, work in fisheries, anywhere you're working out there. I would say if you look a little bit, you'll find what you like.
Well, you said that everywhere has interesting fish and interesting problems, and this next question sometimes generates some pretty interesting answers. But if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Money was not an issue. What project would I like to work on?
I can think of one. You've been trying to get funded.
Yeah, right. We've been trying for 6 or 7 years to get a multi-state grant from NOAA Fisheries to look at the paddlefish. And we struck out to where we just didn't even apply this year. This was not me, but it was eight state managers. And so one of my goals while I was still breathing was to assist all the state managers in having a cooperative management plan for the paddlefish commercial fisheries, and to work with the managers. Like I said, they have the tough job, and get them working as a team and us working together to get a management program. I think that would be the one. And if it wasn't, money wasn't a factor, and before we're done here, Nick, we may have to do it without any money. So your question is a very good one. We may wind up doing it anyway on our own.
And the final question is, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
One program or one principle is, you know, it's pretty hard to distill all this down, but I'm just for people that are in the profession, I would say that all fish deserve our respect and our attention, okay? Even the non-natives we're getting rid of, or we're trying to do that for a reason, but that doesn't mean they should be abused, even if they're removed. I think the principle I would say is that respect for nature is something that I think can separate biologists from everybody else. I always tell my classes, I always say that don't judge your profession, fisheries, by how much people are paying you. Even though they're not paying you a lot to do this work, you have a very important job. You're trying to manage and sustain these fish for future generations. That's a very vital and important task. And I always tell them that do not confuse how much you're being paid with how important your job is. And our job in fisheries research, fisheries management is a very important one. And I believe that. And that's why I'm happy doing what I'm doing. And I'm still doing it at my age. And I encourage other people to just do the same.
Well, Jason and Dennis, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and your new paper you have coming out. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you or find the paper, where would they do that?
They could always email me or search for me on Twitter or ResearchGate. I'm pretty easy to find, I think. You can just Google my name, Jason Schooley, and find me. Dennis is a little less tech savvy, so you can just find me, and I can get you in touch with Dennis. How about that?
I have a website. There's only one Dennis Garnickian in the United States. That might be my only saving grace in this thing. I always refer to Jason as the Svengali of the social media, so he knows his way around it. I don't have a Twitter site. I'm not on all of these things, but I do have a website, so you can look me up that way. Jason has already put our paper on some of the research sites, and I think it's going to wind up on Google Scholar here, available within a month or so, less than that. And it's already been distributed to the agencies. And so just get a hold of us and we'll fix you up with that and whatever papers that you want from us.
And the title again is Bow Fishing in the United States, History, Status, Ecological Impact, and a Need for Management. And the paper was published in Transactions of the Kansas Academy of Science.
Yes, sir.
And if people would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon, or by rocking some awesome Fisheries Podcast logo shirts, hoodies, and even face masks available on Teespring. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 98th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, all fish deserve our respect and attention.